From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Elizabeth Moss Kanter started out writing about communes. Now she writes about the corporate world and is one of today's most sought-after management consultants. On today's Fresh Air, the difficulties of balancing work with a private life. Also today, journalist Pete Hamill looks back on the 1950s, the decade his new novel is set in. Critic at large Laurie Stone reviews a comic novel about coming of age in the 60s. And New Orleans pianist Harry Connick Jr. is back in our weekly performance spot. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. Elizabeth Moss Kanter is an advocate of humanizing the corporate workplace. She is a management consultant who has worked with many Fortune 500 companies, and she holds an endowed chair as professor of business administration at the Harvard Business School. She's written about the corporate world's resistance to change and the problems women and minorities have faced in the system. She's analyzed the innovations which have improved productivity and the quality of life at work. After studying the successes and failures of corporate management in the 70s and 80s, Kanter is now looking ahead to the 90s to see what new challenges await us as America tries to keep competitive while Americans try to balance work with a home life. That's the subject of her new book, When Giants Learn to Dance. Elizabeth Moss Kanter, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Now, you point out that the 80s really brought an emphasis on the entrepreneurial spirit within the corporation. That brought many innovations, but you think it also brought certain excesses which we need to be thinking about as we enter the 90s, such as?
Well, one excess inside the company I called cowboy management, that our model of what it took to be successful was performance shootouts, was rugged individualism and intense competition where department fought with other departments in the same company for resources, or divisions all competed with each other, sometimes for the same customers. That's a style that we thought came out of the entrepreneurial spirit, but it's a style that really gets a company in trouble, because instead of intense competition, we really need more collaboration and teamwork. So inside the workplace, too much competition, and outside the workplace, I became concerned that entrepreneurship and entrepreneurial zeal was creating overload for employees. Too much work to do, too many challenges, too many opportunities. And I think opportunity is great, but I also think that we all want to have a private life, too, and not devote every single moment of our waking existence to work.
You interviewed some of the workers at Apple back before the corporate shakeup there, when Apple was really being praised as the company with the most entrepreneurial spirit and excitement on behalf of the workers and everything. But the workers told you a lot of criticisms that they had about the company. Would you share some of those with us?
Sure, because you can have so much entrepreneurship in which anybody is free to start anything or create a project or define their own plan or system, that you might end up with 17 different forecasting systems. That's what they had at Apple, and they used to joke that they had 17 and none of them worked. In short, they had a lot of trouble harnessing all that great spirit to a shared goal. And so people complained that that didn't give them more power. What it did was make it harder to get lots and lots of enthusiasm behind a single idea that might be the right direction. They also did talk about working much too hard. They were working 12, 14 hours a day. Some people were very proud of it because that was saying, gee, we must be very special people if we can get all of this done. We must be super people. But there were also some concerns about burnout. How long could I keep up that pace?
Okay, so you're critical of some of the entrepreneurial excesses of the 80s. You think that the old-style corporate bureaucracy is kind of becoming obsolete. What are some of the new ideals that you think we should bring with us into the 90s?
Well, I think that we don't want pure bureaucrats. I mean, as we don't want organization man conformists, and I think the male designation did apply, and we don't want just 9-to-5ers who come in the morning, process a certain amount of paper, and go home. But at the same time, we don't want those cowboys who are too competitive and work too hard. So I think the new model would be the athlete, if we have to have an image of the hero in business. I mean, I thought athletes really ought to be the ideal. First of all, we need leaner corporations to begin with that are faster on their feet, and that's really what I mean by a dancing giant. And we also need the skill and the emphasis on professionalism that an athlete has, coupled with the ability to work on teams and to harness that skill in the service of a shared goal. And the other reason I like the athlete image is that I think we're not only competing these days in the business marketplace inside America, but America is playing in a kind of corporate Olympics against other countries. And we need all the skill of the athlete and all the teamwork of companies working together in order to succeed.
You also say that you think we should have loyalty to ethics and to professionalism, to professional standards, and that should supersede our loyalty to the company.
Yes, absolutely. We have a lot of nostalgia today for corporate loyalty and whatever happened to company loyalty. And I'm not sure that old-fashioned company loyalty was such a good thing, because that did often bring us knee-jerk conformity, and I'll do whatever the boss wants, whether it's the right idea or not, and I'll overlook mistakes, or I'll overlook sometimes product defects or moral shortcomings, because if I blew the whistle on them, then I wouldn't be a loyal corporate soldier. So I'm not sure I like that old kind of loyalty. But it was easier to have it in a world when it looked like your future was guaranteed. You'd go to work for a company after high school, and that company might keep promoting you and do the job, and you'd be in that company doing similar kinds of job for life. Well, that world doesn't exist anymore. First of all, I don't think we can afford the waste. I don't think we can afford the product defects. And also, I don't think it's realistic. I think these days, people's careers are going to be defined by their own professional skills, and that means their own pride in the projects they do and the work they perform, rather than expecting Daddy or Mommy Corporation to take care of me for life.
And you think that security will come from knowing you're employable, as opposed to coming from thinking that the corporation will keep you in this job or promote you within the corporation for the rest of your life?
Yes, employability security might be a better basis for security in the future. It's not knowing that my future is guaranteed based on what I'm doing today, but that if I work hard, if I keep my skills current, if I know how to create something myself, if I can think like an entrepreneur, maybe start a business, or maybe at least know how to take initiative, then that's my best hope of remaining employable. If not for this company, then maybe for another company, or maybe for my own business.
Rosabeth Moss-Cantor is my guest. She is a management consultant and author of the new book, When Giants Learn to Dance. I had to tell you the part of your book that struck me as both funny and scary. And you're talking about how busy people are now and how impossible it's become to balance a work life and a home life. And you ask the question, will busier than thou replace holier than thou as the way Americans show off their importance to one another? And it's the first time I came across the idea of busyness as a sign of status or importance. What made you think about that?
Well, I think it goes on among my own peer group, actually, where everybody pulls out their calendar because there's no time to have lunch together. And then instead of simply saying, well, I can't see you until June 23rd, people say, well, gee, I've got breakfast here and lunch here, and I'm going to be in five different cities. I also saw it at Apple, and I saw it in a lot of startup firms, that people were proud of the fact that they were so important that their calendars were crowded all the time. And I began to think that workaholics were not simply psychologically disturbed individuals that could never let go of work, nor were people working so hard just because the corporation was loading it on them. If you're in a world where you're creating something, or you're in charge, or it's yours to do, that's tremendously exhilarating. And so people want to put more time into work and put their identity into work. And so I did see that kind of showing off about, I'm so important because I run all these important projects.
Did this make you rethink your own schedule?
Well, I've always had to work hard on my own schedule, but one of the proposals that I have in the book actually does come out of my experience of what helps me stay sane in my own life, because I have a husband and I have a 10-year-old son, and I adore them, by the way, and the solution to the work-family problem in America is not simply better childcare, although we need better childcare, but people also want to see their families. I mean, I like to actually spend time with my husband and son. And I realized that I'm able to work very, very hard on projects for a defined period of time if I know it's going to be over and there's a reward that comes at the end, like finishing a book and then it comes out, or marketing a new idea, or even finishing teaching a course, and it's a defined period, it's finished, and when it's over, I know that if I need to, I can take the next month a little easier. I could take long weekends. I could bring my child into the office with me during school vacations. And it was that flexibility over the course of a year that helped me keep sane. And then when I saw that in some companies, the people that seemed to do the best job of balancing work and family had that same kind of rhythm in their lives, a project rhythm. Some weeks, yes, they might be traveling and they might have breakfast meetings and go home late for dinner, but other weeks they had a little more control over their time. And if they wanted to, they could work at home a day a week. And that's not just women, by the way. There's a male executive I know, powerful CEO of a powerful New York company, that whenever the weather gets nice, every Friday, he works at his country house and doesn't come into the office, and everybody knows that. And nobody says, by the way, that he's on a mommy track.
Well, let me ask you about the mommy track. This is on the minds of a lot of people right now, and this was the expression given to an idea that was put forth by Felice Schwartz in a recent article. And the idea is that women are more expensive to maintain in corporations, she says, and that we should divide women into two categories, women with a commitment to career and family, and women who are primarily devoted to the career. She says that women primarily devoted to the career can do quite well rising up the corporate ladder. Women who want to divide their time with their family aren't going to rise as well. You're going to have to worry about child care, pregnancy leaves. This was bad news to a lot of women hearing this theory put across. What do you think of it?
Well, I laughed the first time I read her statement that women cost more, and I would have laughed more if people weren't taking it seriously. I actually thought that women, that the evidence said women cost less because you could get away with paying them less and they'd work twice as hard to prove themselves. So we start with a ridiculous premise. I don't think that that differentiation between women who care about their careers and women who care about their kids makes sense at all. I mean, I see in my own life, I wouldn't even know how to answer that question, which is more important to you, work or family. I mean, I fiercely love everything I do, and I know I'm not alone. I mean, my data, my studies, the things I've seen in corporations show that people are getting very angry at that kind of stereotyping and pigeonholing. And among the people who are getting angry are the men of about 35 or 36 that are starting to have their first kids and are falling in love with them and are saying, now, wait a second, I want to be home to change the diapers. I mean, when my husband and I used to compete to see which one could change the diapers because we were so in love with our son, I realized there was a new phenomenon going on in the world. So men are parents, too. I'm concerned about the needs of working parents, not just of women. And I'm very concerned about anything that tracks or stereotypes people because in our rapidly changing world, we need everybody and their skills, and we don't know which skills we're going to need from which department or which level. So how could we possibly say that some people aren't going to get training or some people aren't going to get opportunities? You can see I have a lot to say on this. My parting shot is that I think the assumption behind that argument was an old-fashioned, outmoded assumption that people have a career in a single corporation for life up the corporate ladder, and that's just not true of careers anymore. Most people are going to spend part of their time in business for themselves, part of their time employed by somebody else. Sometimes they'll be a professional independently freelancing. There's just so much more variety in careers today that the idea of rigid tracks simply don't fit what's going on.
I wonder if you think that some people will generalize this into that there should be a mommy track and a daddy track, too, since now men are spending more time with their children. You know, that in other words, that some managers will start dividing the workforce into people with children and people without it, and will look to the single people or the people without children as being the ones who are more potentially productive. Do you think that is happening, and what would... You know, what do you think?
Well, since such a high proportion of the workforce has children, mm-hmm. I don't know who they'd be talking about. First of all, any manager that did that would probably be hurting himself or herself as well, because there aren't enough single people to staff all the important jobs we need. So I could see that people might try to use that to discriminate because stereotyping still does go on, and if we give people a license to discriminate, then they'll do it, but they'd be making a big mistake. In fact, Anybody who's sensible about work will often realize that sometimes it's the busiest people to whom you give projects because it's the busiest people who know how to get things done. And they can be busy for lots of reasons. Some of it's because they have kids, some of it's because they don't. Also, of course, kids make more demands on people at different times in their life. That's not a situation that goes on forever. If people, on the average today, are in the workforce for 35 or 40 years or more in some cases, then the slice of time when they've got young children is such a small slice of life that to make corporate policy around that small slice of life would be ridiculous.
Do you think that the men now who are becoming fathers and who really want to be able to spend some time as fathers at home with their family can be a real help to women so that women aren't discriminated against for being mothers?
Oh, sure.
Do you see that kind of teamwork happening?
In some places where there are more enlightened people, it isn't so much the idea of spending time at home with the children during the work week. Although, as I said, I see male executives spending time at home during the work week because they like to work at home. I think there will be more work at home, and that will be more legitimate. And nobody has to know when you're talking on the telephone or sitting at your computer screen holding a computer conference. Nobody has to know whether what's in the corner is your photography equipment because you're a male photography buff, or whether what's in the corner is your kid in a playpen. So I think that's going to give more freedom, and I think men like that flexibility in their lives too. But I saw something fascinating recently. It didn't happen to come from an American executive, but it was a sign of the times. It was a Swedish CEO who's the CEO of a major company in Sweden. He was needing to create more teamwork in his company, a sense of shared values and so forth. So he decided to take his 40 top managers off to a resort for a week or so. And he decided that he wanted them to bring their families, their spouses, and their children with them because he has a young child. He has two young children, as a matter of fact. And he didn't want to leave them for that period of time. And he realized how important his family was to him. And he said, if I really want spirit and solidarity and teamwork in this company, the families have to be a part of it. And I was really happy about that. I got invited to come as a speaker, and I was told, bring my husband and son. And they got to know the families of this Swedish company. And I thought, what a great role model this is. So it's not simply that you spend time at home with your kids. It's also that I think we have to incorporate the reality of people's families back into the workplace. Why shouldn't kids be able to come and see their parents at work, for example? That's not a disruption. Once in a while it is, I suppose, if you had a lot of toddlers running around the office screaming. Mostly it's a pleasure for people, and boy does it help with that sense of overload. Suddenly, even unmanageable tasks seem more manageable.
Rosabeth Moss-Cantor is my guest, and she's a management consultant. Her new book is called When Giants Learn to Dance. We'll talk more after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Management consultant Rosabeth Moss-Cantor is my guest. She holds an endowed chair as professor of business administration at the Harvard Business School. You've been, throughout your work as a management consultant, looking at how women have been faring in the corporate world. How has what has been happening to women's careers compare with what you thought was going to happen back in, say, 1977 when you were writing about the subject a lot? You know, have women risen as rapidly as you thought that they were going to?
As rapidly. Well, I kept hoping that the rise would be very, very rapid, but that was a hope. In terms of reality, I felt that it would take a critical mass of women with the right credentials and the right track record who couldn't be dismissed as tokens, who couldn't be dismissed as unusual. And it's only been in recent years that we've started to have that critical mass. I mean, many of the women who were once touted as potential CEOs of Fortune 500 companies. I remember all those lists 10 years ago. Many of them were close friends of mine, and so I know what's happened to them. In many cases, they were put in positions where their credentials were maybe okay, but they didn't quite have the experience, but they got an incredible amount of publicity because they were the first division manager in Company X. And because of that, all attention was on them, and if they so much as stumbled, it made headlines. And that spotlight was often very rough on them, and many of those women have gone off to do other things. They've had pauses in their career. They've gone off, for example, to work in consulting firms or search firms or investment firms where they were a partner rather than the CEO. I'm noticing that many of them are going back in now at fairly high levels because they have accumulated more experience. But my hope is the next generation. It's the women who have MBAs, who really understand the business world, who are in their 30s. They are very ambitious. They are beginning to master the work-family dilemmas. They're climbing to good positions. The men around them respect them for what they know and what they can bring. I'm very hopeful about what they'll bring us. A lot of them are also willing to leave to start their own businesses, and I think that's a good route, by the way, because if you can prove that you can lead your own company, you can create something or invent something, and you can run it for profit and do very well, I think that generation of women entrepreneurs are going to look very attractive to the big corporations and watch the big companies start buying up those small companies to get the women leaders.
You've been consulting to corporations for many years now. Were men at the top initially a little reluctant to take advice from you?
Oh, I came with so many credentials. In fact, recently somebody introduced me and read my bio and said I have 10 honorary doctorates. So I got up to the podium, and just for fun, I said, and you can call me Dr., 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 Dr. Cantor. Well, that was a joke, but in fact, having the credentials and being able to be called doctor made a big difference. And I was often got entree despite the fact that I was a woman. It's because somebody had heard me or read about me or read one of the things I had written, and so that was a help. But it has been, when I go off on the corporate retreat with the top executives, I used to laugh and call it me and the boys in Florida. I mean, it is. I am often the only woman there, except for the travel arranger, and that I think is scandalous. In fact, it's led me sometimes to have a little fun with it. I was with one company. There were 200 people in the audience, 4 women and 196 men, and it was a large oil company, and they were a pretty progressive company, and the people at the top seemed to have a good sense of humor. So when I finished and I was giving them a very serious talk about innovation and product development and new technology, but I couldn't resist. When I finished, I said, thank you for being such good hosts and ensuring that everything went smoothly and making sure that there wouldn't be a crowd in the ladies' room.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, well, when I said that, the 4 women in the audience all stood up and cheered. And I think the best we can do with this situation is make jokes about it and make it clear that we're easy to get along with. You know, women can be fun to have in your organization.
Now, I've noticed that you and many other management consultants don't and never have worked in large corporations yourselves.
Well, Harvard University might count as a large corporation. In fact, Harvard probably in budget terms and endowment terms is every bit as big as the Fortune 500. But it's true that many of us who have been both critics and challengers and helpers of the corporation have needed to be from outside. And I'll tell you why. It's because the corporation had been a closed world, listening only to itself, particularly in the 50s and 60s, and what it really needed was refreshing voices from outside. In some cases, I was the first outside speaker that some large corporations had ever brought into their in-house seminars that were held on the premises, and I found that quite striking, that they really had been closed to outside influences. And when that happens, the people who are inside kind of lose perspective, and they need somebody who has a broad view rather than has been socialized into the corporate world to come and help them. And so a lot of companies do deliberately now seek people from different industries or from outside of their business, because that's the way they think they'll get a fresh look and they'll shake up their thinking a little bit.
Before you started consulting to corporations, you were writing about communes. You traveled around the country studying communes. You wrote about it. Is there a connection between communes and corporations for you?
Oh, absolutely. Well, thank you for reminding me of the 1960s. That, in some ways, I miss it because it was so colorful and expressive and exuberant. What I was really studying was commitment, motivation, the building of community. In fact, some people have said, going back to those early writings of mine that actually first appeared in the early 1970s, they've said that I was one of the first writers about corporate culture, because what I was looking at was how strong communities create that feeling of teamwork and solidarity. So that's one thread. The other interesting thread is that many of the people who were the entrepreneurs of the 60s were doing it through alternative organizations of various kinds. And in fact, even Apple Computer really was started by kids who were hippies. It was named Apple because Steve Jobs felt that was his favorite fruit. He was a health food nut. And it's some of the spirit of the 60s and 70s of that youth movement that in fact is infecting the corporation now. And it's those people, it's my generation. I mean, I'm now in my middle 40s, and we're the ones who are climbing to the responsible positions. But we're bringing with us, I think, a different kind of spirit, a view that work should be fun, a view that teamwork makes sense, and that we should be more egalitarian. A lot of the most successful companies today are giving up the big corner office, for example, in favor of a much more democratic, egalitarian workplace. And I think a lot of that's the values of the 60s. And what I brought out of all of those studies was how you do create a better world where people care about their work and feel a sense of mission with each other.
Did you have to wear a business suit when you were visiting communes, or did you end up wearing jeans when you started consulting the corporations?
Oh, that's funny. Well, no, just the opposite, Terry. I wish I could say something colorful about that. But I've always been interested in the leading edge of change, the most innovative things going on in the society. And for a while, a lot of the innovation in the 60s and 70s was coming from those alternative movements. Now, I think where the action is in business. I think a lot of the experimentation and the innovation is coming out of the business world, and it's very exciting. We're still wearing business suits, though. I'm today dressed in a navy blue suit with a blue Oxford cloth blouse.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you for your time.
My pleasure.
Rosabeth Moss Kanter's new book is called When Giants Learn to Dance, Mastering the Challenges of Strategy, Management, and Careers in the 1990s. It's published by Simon & Schuster. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, I'll speak with writer Tobias Wolff. His latest book, This Boy's Life, is a memoir about growing up with his mother with little money and an abusive stepfather after his parents' divorce, and how he assumed poses and told lies to find his way out of that life and become the person he wanted to be. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. As a journalist, Pete Hamill is always writing about today. Writing novels gives him the chance to reflect on the past. Coming up, we look back at the 1950s, the setting of his new novel, Loving Women. Also, New Orleans jazz pianist Harry Connick Jr. joins us in our weekly performance spot. And critic-at-large Laurie Stone introduces us to a new novelist, Sarah Payne Stewart. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. The news from National Public Radio.
This is Brian Naylor. Arriving for talks in West Germany today, Soviet Foreign Minister Eduard Shevardnadze repeated Moscow's call for the removal of all short-range nuclear weapons from Western Europe. Shevardnadze made the comment one day after Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev offered unilaterally to remove 500 short-range nuclear warheads from Europe. Karen Breslau reports.
Shevardnadze's visit comes as NATO member states are racing to come up with a unified position on the modernization and eventual reduction of short-range nuclear missiles before the NATO summit at the end of the month. Referring to the disarray the latest Soviet proposal has created within NATO, Shevardnadze remarked today, "I wouldn't say that our idea has exactly stirred up a lot of enthusiasm with the Americans." Chancellor Helmut Kohl said the Soviet offer was a step in the right direction towards reducing what he called the Soviets' crass superiority in conventional and nuclear arms. But Kohl stressed that he didn't consider it realistic to strive for the complete denuclearization of Europe. Tonight, Shevardnadze joins West German Foreign Minister Hans-Dietrich Genscher for a private dinner. The two will continue their meetings tomorrow. For National Public Radio, this is Karen Breslau in Bonn.
Earlier today, NATO allies gave their qualified support for Gorbachev's plan to unilaterally cut 500 short-range warheads from the Soviet nuclear arsenal. Today, Secretary of State James Baker briefed NATO ministers about the proposal following his two-day visit to Moscow. In a statement, NATO called Gorbachev's offer a welcome, positive, but rather modest step. NATO estimates the Soviet Union has more than 1,400 short-range nuclear missile launchers in Europe against 88 for the Western alliance. U.S. government employees and their families began moving to military bases in Panama today as the first contingent of additional American soldiers arrived in the country. Both steps were ordered yesterday by President Bush in response to the violence triggered by Sunday's disputed elections. Some 3,000 U.S. employees and their dependents are expected to relocate to U.S. bases in the country. The government of dictator Manuel Noriega has yet to comment on Bush's actions. In Washington, meanwhile, the Organization of American States has scheduled a special session for next Wednesday on the Panamanian crisis. In Geneva today, the World Health Organization voted to turn down a request to admit the PLO as a full member state. The vote averted a threatened cutoff of U.S. funds to the agency. Burton Bolag has more.
After 6 hours of tumultuous and often confusing parliamentary maneuvering, World Health Organization member countries adopted a compromise resolution. The text says the Palestinian people should be fully represented at the World Health Organization, but puts off any decision until next year. The final vote was in the form of a secret ballot. Many delegates admitted privately that if the voting had instead been public, the outcome might have been different. After the vote, the Soviet Union announced that it supports Palestinian statehood, but voted for the compromise in order to avoid a confrontation. The U.S. said it was pleased with the result. The PLO, for its part, said it was not discouraged and would continue its attempts to enter other U.N. agencies. For National Public Radio, this is Burton Bolag in Geneva.
The man expected to be South Africa's next president said today that he seeks a drastically changed political system in which neither the white minority nor black majority can dominate. National Party leader F.W. de Klerk told Parliament that the establishment of a one-person, one-vote system would lead to black majority rule, which he termed totally unacceptable. But he said excluding blacks from decision-making would ultimately lead to conflict and revolution. De Klerk said his party seeks a system in which decisions were made by consensus. Stock prices soared today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average shot up nearly 57 points to close the week at 2439.70. Advances led declines 3-1. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. Starting today and continuing for the next several weeks, we'll have a return visit from performer-in-residence Harry Connick Jr. He'll be playing his blend of traditional and modern piano styles and putting some new spin on some old tunes. While still in his early 20s, Harry Connick Jr. has created a stir on the national jazz scene. The Connick name was already well known in his native New Orleans, where his father is the district attorney. Harry Connick Jr. credits his dad for his early musical inspiration.
My dad always tells me new songs to play. He's a big music lover, and he knows probably every standard jazz song and big band song that there is to know. And one song that he showed me when I was a little kid was When You're Smiling. And it was a funny story. When I was at the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival, I surprised everyone in the audience by saying that there was a special guest in the house who was going to come up and sing with me. And my dad came up on the stage and sang this tune with me. And I wish he was here to sing it today, but maybe he would steal the show and I would never be able to get back on NPR again. So anyway, When You're Smiling. When you're smiling, darling, when you're smiling, the whole world smiles with you. When you're laughing, when you're laughing, that sun comes shining through. Oh, but when you're crying, you bring on the rain. So stop your crying and get happy again. 'Cause when you're smiling, or when you're smiling, the whole world smiles with you. Smiling, the whole world was smiling at my pop up there on the stage, sounding like Frank Sinatra with his microphone and doing his little dance. Yeah, he was something else that day. One of the tunes I used to play in New Orleans is another tune. I should dedicate this while I'm on the subject of my father to him, because I love him no greater than anyone. You know what I'm trying to say. I love him a lot, and there is no greater love than my pop. Thank you.
Harry Connick Jr. records for Columbia Records. He'll be back with us next week. This is Fresh Air. Hamill is a veteran New York journalist and a streetwise columnist. He knows politics and the neighborhoods inside out. He's written for the New York Post, the Daily News, New York Magazine, and the Village Voice. He just gave up his New York Post column, a reaction in part to an editorial dispute. As a journalist, Hamill is always writing about today. Writing novels gives him a chance to look back. In his new novel, Loving Women, a 51-year-old photographer reflects on his coming of age, his Navy days, stationed in Pensacola. Setting these reflections in the 1950s was a way for Hamill to understand the present.
When you try to figure out why things change, you have to start from some point at which they were different. And I wanted to do a novel like this for years and years and years and never felt equipped to do it. I didn't think I had the craft at the time when I was younger. But it occurred to me finally that the point of a novel like this would be that it takes place before everything changed in America. This particular novel, Loving Women, is set in 1953, which is a year before the Supreme Court decision that got rid of segregated schools. It's 2 years before the advent of rock and roll. It's before the pill, before a whole lot of things that began to change the national life, particularly as manifested in the 60s. And I think looking back at that and trying to understand what we were, particularly emotionally rather than factually the way history does, was the original impulse that brought me to decide finally it was time to write this novel.
Now, you, like your character, had enlisted in the Navy.
That's true.
What got you into the Navy?
Well, my grandfather, Peter Devlin, had been a seaman who traveled all around the world and got killed, actually, working for the Grace Line in Brooklyn in the early part of the century, 1916. So there was a sense of the sea in our family from that side of the family. And also in my neighborhood, for some reason, everybody in Brooklyn growing up, everybody tended to go to the Navy. I think because our fathers worked at the Brooklyn Navy Yard, as I did before I went in the Navy as a sheet metal worker. And a lot of them worked at Todd Shipyards and built ships. And so ships and the ocean were really part of it.
Well, you were used to ships, but you weren't used to the South.
That's true. That's true. The South, to a kid from Brooklyn in those days, and we're talking again before everything, this was before television made such an impact on American life, the South was like another country. I arrived the day Hank Williams died, and people were moaning and wailing and crying, and the radio stations were full of all this news, and I had no idea who Hank Williams was. When you went South in those days, everything was different, the architecture, the food, and most of all, the music. The key thing, though, for a white kid from the North in those days was the encounter with racism, and a lot of this novel is about that.
Your novel's called Loving Women, and in the prologue to the novel, the main character, who's in his 50s, is separating from a younger woman. Actually, she's leaving him. And then in the flashback, when he's a younger man, he falls in love with an older woman. Of course, this made me think about how, as a more mature man, this man wanted a woman to make him feel younger, and as a younger man, he wanted a woman to make him feel more mature.
Well, I hadn't actually thought of that, but you're absolutely right. So I guess things all even out in the end. Divide by two, and we end up with one whole woman.
Well, has writing this made you think about what you've looked for in women during your life?
Oh, sure. I mean, all the way through it, I was conscious of the kinds of imprints that are placed in your brain, I guess, when you're very young, and why some men always marry the same woman. They always marry redheads with freckles, or they always marry tall, thin girls, or great, lovely, fat girls, or whatever. I think there are certain imprints that that attract you to certain kinds of types to start with. It's later when you break down and find out who these individual people are, what an individual woman is, what an individual man is, that you begin to act like a human instead of a categorizer.
Mm-hmm. Did you lose your virginity in the Navy?
I certainly did.
Was it as dramatic a scene as it is in your book?
I'm sure it was not. Certainly for my correspondent, I'm sure it wasn't. But you got to start somewhere.
You know, I'm thinking in the very end of the book, and I hope you don't think I'm giving too much away here, but the character returns to the South and in search of this woman who he met when he was younger, a woman who was older than him. And it made me think that she'd probably be, what, in her 60s or 70s?
Exactly,
by
yeah,
then.
Right.
And you wonder if he'd found her, if he'd still have any attraction for her, considering he just left a woman who's far younger. I mean, he was just with a woman who's far younger than he was.
Well, that part of it, who knows with that? I've had friends who've, in fact, had that experience. In fact, people who were married briefly when they were 20 or something and couldn't work it out, and then find themselves again when they were in their 60s. And it has worked, because the kinds of superficial things that you look for in women when you're a kid certainly don't matter at all to mature people. I mean, what people look like and all the rest of it, it becomes much less important to everybody, and character becomes everything.
The character in your novel knows how to use his fists and has to sometimes use them. I assume that you know that, too. How did you learn how to fight?
I don't know if you really learn how to fight, but in the neighborhood where I grew up, in Brooklyn, which was a basically working-class neighborhood, people who were, quote, good with their hands, unquote, were respected more than people who were good with their minds. It was just a kind of a natural thing. And if you were good at school, which I was when I was a kid, it became even more important to be able to be a tough guy. And it was always a kind of a silly thing to do. But I did go to the gym, and I learned how to box, and I had a lot of fights in the street, and I won most of them and broke my hand twice and did all kinds of things like that. And I don't regret any of that, but I look back at it as kind of one of those silly rites of passage that some men have to go through.
When you became a columnist in New York, what function did you see your column as serving?
Well, when I started, I had this sort of basic sense that it would be a column about New York. I always liked Mencken's dictum that the purpose of journalism was to comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable. And I thought that's what I would do, and that was in 1965. By 1966, we were deep into the war in Vietnam, and it really changed a lot of what I did. The column was affected by the world rather than being really something that I could choose. There was no way not to cover the 60s as they began to develop after 65, 66, and no way to avoid Vietnam and its consequences, which were Watergate, the Nixon era, etc. So I became a much more political columnist than I started out to become. I have no regrets over that. There's nothing you can do about things like that. The world changes you when you're a journalist. Or you better let it. If you don't, you find yourself writing in some kind of weird vacuum where it makes no sense and has no connection to the audience. So it did change me quite a bit.
The last time we spoke on this program, and I think this was a couple of years ago, you had just gotten back to New York from editing an English-speaking newspaper in Mexico.
Right.
And you had started writing a column for the New York Post
right.
back in New York. Now you're leaving the Post, and you'll be writing for Esquire. Did the disagreement over the Jacqueline Kennedy excerpt in the Post have to do with your leaving?
Well, it didn't make it more attractive to stay. Let's put it that way. But it was not the reason for leaving. I had been unhappy with the form rather than the situation at the paper. The actual form of a newspaper column, of trying to say something in 630 words without coarsening or vulgarizing the subject, is the thing that really got to me. At my age, I want to write the best work I'm capable of doing and not just hold a job or have a career or anything like that. It's too late for all that. I just want to do good work and be the best craftsman I can be. And the limitations of the column had much more to do with it than that particular column.
Okay. Thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Pete Hamill's new novel, Loving Women, is published by Random House. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered and check in with co-host Robert Siegel. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry. We'll be hearing from Brussels on today's program from NPR's Bill Buesenberg. You know, Secretary of State Baker is back from Moscow, and he's has now run past the other NATO ministers, the unilateral announcement by the Soviet Union that they're going to withdraw 500 short-range nuclear warheads. We'll hear how that's playing in Europe. We'll also hear about President Bush's speech in Texas today, in which he made the first of what we expect will be three speeches on U.S. policy toward the Soviet Union. The president speaks in terms of an open skies policy in Europe that all planes will be able to inspect things in East and Western Europe.
Thanks, Robert. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Men in Trouble is the first novel by Sarah Payne Stewart, a writer who lives in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Like the main character in her book, Stewart grew up in that area, but she insists her novel isn't autobiographical. After several short careers as a typist, copywriter, and screenwriter, Stewart wrote Men in Trouble after her second child was born. She says it was probably because writing was so much easier than getting those snowsuits on. Critic at large Laurie Stone has a review.
Men in Trouble is a joyous comic novel that reads like a breathless 200-page letter written from the front of the 1960s. The story zigzags from episode to episode, but what holds it together and keeps our interest alive is the wry, honest voice of Lizzie, the narrator. The men in trouble are her talented, brainy brothers, George and Spencer. They grow up in Concord, Mass, amid shabby gentility and a respect for eccentricity. Lizzie knows Spencer is cool when, at his high school graduation, he says, quote, "Thanks, baby," straight into the microphone as his ancient teacher, Miss Clippinger, hands him his diploma. Lizzie follows her brothers to Harvard, Radcliffe for her, where they drop in and out of school as well as reality. Spencer, who affects women the way catnip does cats, goes the way of ashrams. Harry, a musical genius, goes crazy and needs to be institutionalized. Lizzie feels, above all, that she must save Harry in order to reconstitute the family which she remembers as hopeful and glowing. It also gives her something to do when she isn't dieting on some weird dry cereal regime or nailing her flesh to the doomed love of a depressed guy she isn't related to. This is typical growing up stuff, sure, but Stewart's alert, nuanced writing keeps it fresh and enjoyable. Voice, voice, voice is all we've heard about fiction for the past decade or so. This has mostly referred to brand name droppers and bards of inarticulateness who substitute photographic renderings for a shaped point of view. No such evasiveness or wrought, callow cool blights Stewart's prose. Her wit is the simple, unblinking harvest of penetrating sifting. She has opinions, she feels. This summary of a party scene is a typically neat blending of social satire and self-revelation. She says, "I'm sure these relationships were quite meaningful for the few hours they lasted. There was a tall black guy who was trying to give up white girls, and two or three who wore rags and were always borrowing money to go to the movies and later got trust funds of $1 million. There was the boy with the goatee who made me stare with him at the fish in his aquarium and told me his roommates thought I was a narc because I didn't smoke pot." No character but Lizzie comes vividly into view, and Stewart doesn't deeply probe the causes of emotional pain. Lizzie presents her family's proneness to collapse as a tribal trait, and Harry's mania is unconvincingly reduced to a fear of failure. It's difficult for a comic writer fully to express sadness, although Stewart does often manage to be both pointed and funny. Lizzie's reticence comes off like a byproduct of her genteel heritage, but uncharacteristically, Stewart doesn't have Lizzie reflect on this. Most of the time, though, the comic tone is marvelously apt. Lizzie can't save her brothers, but the mutual devotion the members of the family exhibit helps the weakest links to rickety stability. Most convincing, we're shown that Lizzie survives her binges on soft cakes and hard cases, because the rueful, unashamed candor with which she speaks is an unfailing refuge from despair.
Laurie Stone is a New York-based writer and critic, and is a contributor to The Village Voice. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time, we meet Illinois Jacquette. His honking tenor saxophone solos inspired many rhythm and blues players. We'll look back on his days with Count Basie and Lionel Hampton and hear the big band Jacquette now leads. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews Let's Get Lost. It's a new documentary on the late trumpeter and singer Chet Baker. And television critic David Bianculli watches the finales of Miami Vice and Family Ties. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Amy Sallet, and Fred Landerl. Production assistants from Lisa Bruton and Ed Doherty. Research assistants from Christopher Cook and Laura Sivitz. Our engineer is Thad Kirk. Chris Burgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.